From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Ross Perot and Ralph Nader didn't win the presidency, but they sure shook up American politics. Who were the independent and third-party candidates in election 2008, and how are independent voters reshaping the political system? With us, we've got Michael C. Dawson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, can you define the difference between an independent and a third-party candidate?
Well, there's been independent candidates that have been quite important, such as Harold Washington in Chicago in the 1980s. But they're not necessarily affiliated with a political party around a set of issues. Often they're around in their own personality. You might want to put Ralph Nader into that category for 2008. An independent third party is actually a party that forms under a number of different circumstances around a set of issues. A platform usually has a slate of candidates, often runs in multiple states or in a region or in multiple counties, in the case of the South in the 1960s.
So we're going to speak in a bit with Bob Barr of the Libertarian Party, the presidential candidate. But what other parties are there out there that are running in election 2008?
Well, there's the Green Party, which has been a presence for several years, which Ralph Nader ran on in the 1990s, of course. There's the Constitution Party, the Libertarian Party. Those are three of the biggest parties, and Ralph Nader is running as an independent this time.
So given that there's been a tremendous amount of energy around the two major party candidates in election 2008, do you think that this year third-party and independent party candidates are being overshadowed?
I think they're being somewhat overshadowed, which does not mean they won't have an effect. They could have an effect in specific states, given our federal system, and could be decisive, although I don't think in 2008 that's going to happen.
Now, okay, if you decide that you want to run as a member of a third party, there is a campaign finance rule that, you know, that basically says if you get a certain percentage of the vote that you can get federal funding. Explain a little bit more, because that was one of the rationales why some people voted for Ralph Nader. Explain a little bit more about that system.
Well, there's a number of barriers that a third party candidates have to face. One is media coverage. As we know from the debates, the networks are saying you have to have 15% of the polling nationally before they'll put you on the national debates. There's finance. You have to qualify for campaign financing. Third is ballot access is another problem that third candidates face, and that varies from state to state. So not only does a candidate have to meet the campaign expenditures and try to get federal money they're financing themselves, like Ross Perot, they also have 50 different sets of laws they have to combat if they're trying to run for a president in the United States.
What do we know about independent and third-party voters? How are they different, if at all, from people who vote Democratic or Republican?
Independent voters are an increasing trend in the United States. They've been growing steadily for a number of decades now. And they may be people that are in the middle of the political spectrum between the Democrats and Republicans. So while third-party voters tend to have a different set of concerns, either they're on the fringes or the extremes of the parties, like Green Party are more radical, left populists than the Democrats are, or they have a set of single interests they're interested in, like in terms of libertarians, the degree the state interferes with the liberty of its citizens from their point of view. So third-party candidates have a reason to not belong to one of the two parties, while independents may fall into that category, or they may just fall into the middle of the American political spectrum.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Michael C. Dawson, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He joined us from the university studios. And one of the most high-profile third-party candidates this election season is former Congressman Bob Barr. He's running for president on the Libertarian Party ticket. Congressman Barr, welcome to News and Notes.
It's great to be with you all. Thank you for having me.
So you just heard Professor Dawson talk about what specific parties bring to the table. Give us a pitch for the Libertarian Party. What is it that you stand for?
We stand for dramatically smaller government and greatly enhanced personal liberty. The Republican Party, for example, in recent years, and this is illustrated very, very clearly by Senator McCain, has become a party that believes in ever stronger executive branch power, whether it is in the economic arena to control financial institutions now with direct government involvement, or whether it's in the area of our civil liberties by supporting, as Senator McCain does, the government spying on its own citizens without court order. The Republican Party has become very much a party of big government. The Democratic Party, of course, has always been a party that believes in aggressive, proactive use of the government and taxpayer money to effect social change, so that's really no surprise. But what the American people have been left with in recent cycles is simply voting for the party of big government or the party of bigger government between the Republicans and Democrats. We in the Libertarian Party believe the American people deserve and should have a real choice to send a real message to return to a large extent to the government of our prior generations, where the maximum power resided in individuals, families, small businesses in our communities. Decisions were made by people voting in their state and local elections and not by the heavy hand of big government.
Well, Congressman, you've been talking mainly in a fiscal context, but you also have talked about how you didn't always see eye to eye with the Libertarian Party on issues like drug use or drug laws. Tell me about how you shifted on that.
Well, the important thing, of course, to keep in mind in this election cycle is the tremendous differences between the Libertarian Party and the Democrat and Republican, not so much what my position used to be or is or is not the same as other libertarians. But the position that I have is one that believes strongly in getting the federal government out of these issues, getting the federal government out of social policies, getting the government out of drug policies, leaving those up to the individuals in the states to decide. The wake-up call for me and many other Americans really was the tremendous unbridled growth in government power since 9/11. That has dramatically increased the sphere of government power and necessarily and correspondingly decreased dramatically the sphere of personal liberty. And we need to start regaining that personal liberty before it gets so small and the oppressive nature of big government so powerful that it's impossible to reverse that trend.
Now, the Green Party nominee for president, Cynthia McKinney, was also formerly a member of Congress, also representing a district in Georgia. She was a Democrat, you were a Republican. If you look at your conservative voting record and her liberal voting record, you obviously have a lot of differences. But what do you think you have in common as third-party candidates in 2008?
Well, I'm not familiar with all the details of her candidacy, so I can't really answer that. Again, though, what we are trying to do in the Libertarian Party is present to the American people, and I presume that Ms. McKinney is trying to do the same thing for her party, a real choice, not simply voting for the lesser of two evils, which is what many Americans believe their choices have been reduced to with Republicans and Democrats, sort of going into the polling booth and holding their nose and voting for the lesser of two evils. I and we in the Libertarian Party believe that America deserves better than that.
Is this the wrong year? And what I mean by that is you have one of these moments in history where for different reasons people are completely passionate about Senator Obama and Senator McCain and sometimes in disagreeable opposition to each other. Is this the wrong year to really make a stand as a third party candidate?
Quite the opposite. The fact of the matter is that there is actually very little passionate support for Senator McCain. He just doesn't engender that. There is a core group of Republicans that are passionate, certainly, about their party, regardless of policy so much. But if you look at the recent nonpartisan polling that indicates that upwards of 80 or 85% of the American people believe the country is going in the wrong direction on the wrong track, that clearly indicates an opportunity for a third party, for a new choice. The American people are very dissatisfied fundamentally with the two-party system and the choices or lack of choices that it's presented to them cycle after cycle.
All right, the Electoral College. It is a system that has been criticized from many quarters, including within the two major parties. How does that affect your ability to do what you do and run as a third-party candidate?
Well, what really dramatically hurts us in the Libertarian Party as a third party is not so much the Electoral College, as it is the monopoly hold that the two other major parties, Republican and Democrat, have on the American electorate and on much of the mainstream media. The manner in which they fight to keep candidates, independent and third-party candidates, off the ballot, illustrated by the almost impossible burden that the established two parties are able to exert in Oklahoma to make it virtually impossible for an independent or a third-party candidate for president to even get on the ballot. The illustration of Texas, in which both the Republican and Democratic parties this year failed to certify their candidates on time, that is, within the time required by Texas law. But the Texas Supreme Court said basically that doesn't matter. We're going to let them on the ballot anyway. So there's two sets of rules. One set of rules for third party and independent candidates that make it very difficult sometimes, if not impossible, to get on the ballot, and a set of rules for the Republicans and Democrats, which means that they're going to get on the ballot no matter what, even if they fail to meet the legal criteria. And the debates, such as they are completely stacked against anybody but a Republican and Democrat participant. They say that if you poll at 15%, we might allow you to participate in the debates. But the fact of the matter is that the polls that they use to gauge whether or not a person, a candidate, reaches 15% don't poll for third candidates anyway. So it's impossible to get into the debates.
Congressman, thanks for your time.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you for having me.
That was former Congressman Bob Barr. He's the presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party. We also reached out to other independent and third-party presidential nominees for this segment. You can find details on all the presidential nominees at our website, nprnewsandviews.org. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki is confident he can save a power-sharing deal in Zimbabwe. And in South Africa, the former defense minister announced he wants to form a new political party. Roxanne Lawson is here for this week's Africa Update, and she's director of Africa Policy for TransAfrica Forum. Hi, Roxanne.
Hello, Farai.
So South African politics haven't been this volatile since the end of apartheid. You have Thabo Mbeki, who was ousted as president last month. There's deeply held resentments between members of the ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC. And last Wednesday, Mosiwa Lekota, sorry for butchering his name, a former defense minister, announced plans to leave the ANC and form his own political party.
Sir, it seems that we are serving today divorce papers. This is probably the parting of the ways. It probably is. We hope that sense may still prevail in others to review their position. If not, there's no going back.
All right, so the ANC suspended him for threatening to leave the party. What does that really mean about the future of multi-party politics in South Africa?
Well, I think we're in a really interesting time and place in the evolution of South African politics. One thing that I think everyone can agree upon on some level, although it hurts us to say, is that South Africa really does need to have a viable multi-party system for the long-term cohesiveness and health of its democracy. And so what we're seeing now is the maturation of politics in South Africa and perhaps some really good movement looking over the next couple of months. The impact this is going to have on the elections, though, in April is still really unknown. I don't know, actually, if this national summit, which Mr. Lekota has called for, will actually birth a new political party that's really viable. I mean, there are several political parties that exist in South Africa aside from the ANC, but a political party that actually has the unity and the base, the broad base that the ANC enjoys, would be something that would actually be quite good for South African politics. I think also we're seeing the teasing out of the different political paradigms existing within South Africa. There is a raging debate around neoliberal economic structures, whether or not South Africa should support and further a neoliberal paradigm of like investment and trade and privatization, or if it should actually stay closer to its revolutionary roots with a much more kind of socialist economy. And I think we're seeing some of that play out, and it'll be quite interesting to kind of see if all of this kind of wrangling that's happening right now can move out of the personality of party politics to real party politics and difference.
We have a situation where, you know, the ANC obviously came out of, as you mentioned, a long revolutionary struggle and a political struggle. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu said in an interview that a new party would be good for South Africa. He said democracy flourishes where there's vigorous debate. You mentioned some of the pivot points for that debate, but how is it playing out in terms of ethnicity support, ethnicity-based support, and economic-based support? Who is leaning in what direction for what reasons out of the citizenry?
I think there's actually several different kind of factions. There are obviously the mass majority of poor South Africans, regardless of ethnicity, that are critical of the ANC and what's delivered to them over the last, let's say, 8 years of Thabo Mbeki, but also longer than that, since 1994, since their revolution ended. And then within that, though, are several different camps. There is the business community, the kind of black empowerment, upper middle class Africans who've actually really risen to stature and power over the last couple of years, who are supportive of Jacob Zuma because they feel like that he will speak to them politically. The same, though, kind of strangely, the same factions, which in the very poor classes of South Africa, are also supportive of Jacob Zuma, in part because they are really attached to his personality, because he's very charismatic, because he's a revolutionary leader, and he has yet to tease out kind of how he'll be different. It'll be interesting to see how Lakota, if he actually does have this new party, how that new party will establish themselves, if they will pull on the kind of black bourgeoisie of South Africa, and as well as white South Africans and multi-ethnic South Africans of a certain political class and economic class to actually be their base, or if they'll look elsewhere for those things. I think Jacob Zuma, who a couple of months ago we would have said would be a shoo-in for the next president of South Africa, is now in a very politically precarious situation. He's going to really have to get together in the next couple of months and put together a strong platform and sit for MP in KwaZulu-Natal, where he's from, which is a Zulu part of South Africa, and see if he can actually become their MP, which then will put him in line for presidency. But with the split in the ANC, I think it's kind of all bets are off. It's a really exciting time to watch South African democracy because all of this is happening in a very non-violent, democratic way.
All right. Let's move on to Zimbabwe. It's all interrelated. After these contentious and violent elections and then a sort of failure of the runoff election, these two rival parties just said, okay, we're going to share power. However, a lot of people thought it wasn't going to work. Now there's some huge problems. And Thabo Mbeki, the recently former president of South Africa, has been the one really trying to broker a deal between President Mugabe and the Movement for Democratic Change. Where does that stand?
It stands in a very, very precarious place. I think the majority of Zimbabweans, the people I've been talking to over the last couple of weeks, are really quite aware of this. This power sharing agreement was signed September 15th, almost a month ago. And since then, there's been no movement forward and very, very many steps backward. We saw on Friday that Robert Mugabe, after meeting with Morgan Tsvangirai and the rest of the MDC, that Robert Mugabe and ZANU-PF issued a statement announcing who the ministers were going to be, which was part of the negotiation process, kind of unilaterally decided. I think that, unfortunately, both ZANU-PF and MDC did not enter into these negotiations with the best of faith in each other because of their political differences, their ideological differences, the differences in their base, and that all we've seen is just a bunch of conversation between the political elite while the majority of Zimbabweans are getting deeper and deeper marred into poverty and debt and why the food crisis continues in Zimbabwe. It's unfortunate, though, that very little has happened, that despite, you know, the $231 million million percent inflation in Zimbabwe, that the only ministerial post that has not been really even discussed, let alone decided on, is the Minister of Finance, which is what Zimbabwe needs to move forward. I think that many people watching in Zimbabwe knew this was going to happen all along, and it scares them, but it actually is what they expected to happen from the beginning. And so I think the tenor on the ground is actually just deeper despair.
I was speaking to someone who said that what has happened is that a lot of people have either, you know, gotten out of the country if they can, or moved back to rural areas where at least you can grow your own food. Do you have a sense of how people are coping on the ground in Zimbabwe with the fact that there's not really a viable economic system?
I think what you're hearing is true, that there are great numbers of people who are trying to leave the country, although it's very difficult to cross the Zimbabwean border right now into the neighboring states. Some people have actually gone back to the rural areas to try to plant for this harvest season. But many people who are urban dwellers without the money or the capital to go back to rural areas, without the simple, you know, enough water to actually get them from one part of town to the other, are stuck where they are. And I think that's what's contributing to the despair as these negotiations continue on with no end in sight. It's quite troubling, actually, to think about the fact that the Movement for Democratic Change entered into negotiations with kind of four things they wanted to get out of negotiations for them to be legitimate, and had conceded on every single one of those points. And the same time, ZANU-PF has entered into negotiations saying that they actually want to have a way forward, yet have been operating the way they've been operating the last 20 years in Zimbabwe. And so there really is a void in political leadership, and a political leadership that's attached to local Zimbabweans and what they are needing right now. And that's what's deeply troubling. The Zimbabweans I've been talking to over the last couple of days have just been utterly dismayed at the inability of their government to govern.
Really quickly, how do you interact, and this has to be really quick, how do you interact with this whole situation as an organization?
As TransAfrica Forum, we are daily having briefings from civil society organizations in Zimbabwe, as well as trying to talk to regular citizens, people who are working in all manner of different things, or not working at all, people that we know through contacts, colleagues of colleagues, to get a sense from them about what's really going on. It's one thing to talk to non-governmental organizations. It's a different thing to talk to Zimbabweans on the ground. And that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to amplify their voices, because as the ministers and the heads of state meet, average Zimbabweans are lost in that dialogue.
Roxanne, thank you.
Thank you.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for TransAfrica Forum, and she was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Indian filmmakers created Bollywood, but have you heard about Nollywood? We're talking about the Nigerian film industry, and it's largely unknown outside of Africa. Over the past 10 years, Nollywood has grown into a $250 million a year enterprise that employs thousands of people. Now the documentary Welcome to Nollywood gives us a behind-the-scenes look at Nigerian filmmakers and their impact on African culture.
Nollywood films are so popular around Africa because people can relate to the stories that we do.
We are telling African stories from an African perspective, slow, very dialogue-oriented, because we are a speaking people.
NPR's Tony Cox sat down with the documentary's director, Jamie Meltzer, plus Nigerian film director Izu Ojukwu.
Let's start with this. Izu, the film industry in Nigeria, most people do not associate it with movie making, but apparently movie making is really a big deal there.
Yeah. Nigerians call them home videos, you know, so that will get away with a lot of things easily. Yeah.
Instead of saying movies, they say home
videos.
Yeah,
yeah, call them home videos back home, yeah.
Well, home videos in the States mean something entirely different, I suppose.
Yeah.
But how big is the home movie, home video business in Nigeria?
It's very big. It is next to the oil in Nigeria. It's very big. It has taken thousands of youths off the streets, you know, in different aspects.
Which kind of movie, which genre of home video is the one that is the most popular?
Comedy.
Comedy?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you.
You did a documentary about Nollywood, as it's called. What we are talking about, did it come as a surprise to you to discover what's occurring?
It did. It really did. I first heard about Nollywood when I was finishing up a previous documentary. A documentary had taken me about 4 or 5 years to complete, which is not unusual. At that time, I read about Nollywood in the paper, where they're finishing films, you know, in a couple weeks and then putting them out to the market and having immediate successes with their films. So basically for me, the film was about seeing the model that the Nigerian independent filmmakers had set up as an inspiration for all independent filmmakers, including myself.
What is it about that model? Is it A, the speed with which these films are being produced, the distribution system that they have, the low overhead that perhaps they may have? What is it that you feel is worth modeling yourself after or others here in the States?
Well, it's a little bit more abstract than that for me. For me, it's about an example, in other words, an example of filmmakers kind of making the best situation out of what they have, and that's certainly what they've done in Nigeria. In Lagos, where most of my documentary was shot and where Izu works all the time as a director, power is hardly on, you know, for most of the day. So how do you shoot a film when you don't have lights, when you don't have power? You know, you make do. You figure out a way around it. How do you make a film when there's no financing from banks or from, you know, or the government? You know, you find entrepreneurs, you know, to invest, and, you know, you do it with small amounts of money. So it's just the way in which they figured out, according to their own circumstances and context, how to make a film industry work is just sort of an example to inspire everyone to try to do the same within their own context. You know, in other words,
In the documentary, we saw just what Jamie was talking about, power going out, money coming up short, disgruntled actors, all of that, and then having a place to distribute your work. Quantity is one thing. Quality is another. As frankly as you can, talk about the quality of these films, these home videos that are being made in Nigeria. Are they any good?
From Nigerian action master Izu Ojukwu, a tale of conspiracy at the upper echelons of power. Who will tell the president?
Well, majority of the filmmakers in Nigeria basically do these things to survive. And you know, the dark age of military regime in my country sort of set things back. The filmmakers couldn't afford to move forward. So an alternative solution was created, you know, to get your camera out, shoot something, and then we have to survive. But now it's changing gradually. People are beginning, professionals, you know, trained filmmakers are coming in. They're coming back to the business again, and they're trying to revive the industry.
How do you handle distribution, and how are people able to actually see the work that you produce?
Well, in Nigeria, at least, we have a very good distribution network in Nigeria for our local consumers. So generally, the marketers have outlets all scattered all over the country. So once a movie is released, they get their distributors and it gets to the, you know, consumers.
Jamie, what's the purpose of the documentary that you did about Nigerian filmmaking besides to expose it to the rest of the world that may not know what's taking place there?
I think, for me, the film is also about showing a different side of Africa at large, because I think in the U.S., as consumers of media, we don't really get a fair picture of what's going on in Africa, of the complexity of African countries and people. And so I thought this kind of a film that focuses on a very positive part of African life and something that Nigerian directors and filmmakers and producers, you know, creating this industry on their own, you know, have created something without any outside support or anything like that. That kind of story, again, that inspirational kind of story, for me, felt very different than any other stories I'd seen being represented in our media about Africa. And to me, that was kind of an important point that I wanted to get across.
Izu, just a couple of more things. How difficult is it to do some of the more complicated kinds of crash scenes and explosions and things, fires and all that stuff that you see in action films? In the documentary, they showed how, you know, you guys put the blood in the water when they had the war scene and stuff. How hard is it to get those things that Hollywood is now generating via computer?
It is difficult, you know. This is like in the movie I shot while Jamie was in Nigeria. It took me 7 months to get the attention of the Nigerian army. And it's the first time they would give that kind of support to an independent filmmaker, to any filmmaker at all. So I stayed and then, you know, was constantly visiting the Army headquarters until the Army Chief of Staff, you know, approved those props. And I had bomb engineers, you know, on set. So, I mean, it's the first time anything like that is happening in Nigeria. So it indicates that the future is bright for the Nigerian movie industry.
Jamie, you want to add anything to that, what you've seen in comparing films made in Nollywood versus those you've seen made in Hollywood?
You know, there's all kinds of films being made in Nigeria, political thrillers and action movies. And so it's a really interesting industry to me in terms of, you know, continually defining itself and redefining itself. It's also very responsive to the news cycle. I mean, think about it. In the U.S., we can't be as responsive to our news cycle because it takes us several years to make a film. But in Nigeria, if you can make a film in a month or 6 weeks and get it out, you can be really responsive to what's happening in the news media. So there was a lot of talk about those kinds of films, whether it reflect political reality or some sort of social reality.
Jamie, Isu, thank you both.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Good
Thanks.
Luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Meltzer, director of the documentary Welcome to Nollywood, along with Nigerian film director Izu Ojukwu. They spoke with NPR's Tony Cox. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Weddings can be the best of times and the worst of times. But the new film, Rachel Getting Married, isn't just about getting hitched. Instead, it tells the bittersweet story of a troubled young woman who leaves rehab to take part in her sister's wedding. With us today is Jenny Lumet, screenwriter for the film, Rachel Getting Married. So how did this even come up as an idea for you?
Weddings make people insane, and families are the greatest source of material on the planet. And so the combination of the two is so unbelievably rich. I think that we've all seen the wedding movie where it's the perfect wedding, and then the bad friend or the bad sister or the black sheep of the family comes and ruins it. And I think it's a lot more interesting to turn something like that completely on its ear.
Well, let's get into the movie. You've got Anne Hathaway playing Kim, an addict with a troubled past who leaves rehab to be in her sister Rachel's lavish wedding.
So are all of these energetic young wedding helpers staying at the house? Because after 9 months of constantly revolving cellmates and crazy people...
You weren't in a cell, Kim.
Groups. Well, I was sort of looking forward to a little privacy for once.
Anne is known as, you know, she's played princesses. And who is she as Kim?
She's the anti-princess. She's kind of like the lioness in the jungle who makes every stupid choice you could possibly make. She does everything wrong. What she really has to do is get through this weekend. And what everybody else in the family really has to do is get through this weekend. And everybody has their own reasons why that's going to be so freaking difficult.
You also create a world where there are blended families, people who've divorced and gotten remarried. That aspect really struck me as something where it does get portrayed, but often not very well. Did you deliberately set out to make that a big part of the movie?
I wanted to be as honest as possible. And in listening to this characters, and it is hard to talk about process without sounding a little, I don't know, sort of hokey, and I'll try not to sound like that, but I was listening really, really carefully to these characters, and this seemed to me what they would do and how they would be. And I can honestly say that I set about to make no statements at all. I just tried really hard to be brave and write honestly. It just seems to me that the perfect family, even with a, you know, maybe divorced family, and you have the wisecracking guy over here and that sort of sitcom multifamily thing, even there, I think that's kind of a myth.
I mean, do you think that right now, as America is examining itself closely in the mirror with politics and race and all sorts of other issues, do you find that people who see your film walk away with different impressions of what it is and what it does?
Yeah. Absolutely. Some people feel that I was attempting to make some statement about racial harmony. No, that's kind of just what my house looks like. My mom's black and my dad's white, and one of my white cousins in California married an Asian guy, and they have these gorgeous little babies. Some of the European press asked me if I had made a movie that was analogous to the state of America, and we can heal each other only through an understanding and a talking about of race. And some people say, what is she talking about with all the multi-culti? It's like a bee-in, and it's, you know, sort of this sort of hippy-dippy. And I gotta say, this is just what my house looks like.
Jonathan Demme, director, someone who has been an innovator. This is your first produced screenplay, and you come from a very strong, established artistic family. But how did you guys hook up?
Oh, I totally stalked him. Totally stalked him. You can't. The system's not set up so you can do this kind of thing without a connection. I'm positive there are 19 brilliant screenwriters in my building that just can't get their stuff to the right person. And so I stalked him and I Googled him and I found out everything I could. And eventually I extorted my dad and I said, you know, they knew
director
each other.
Director Sidney Lumet.
Director Sidney Lumet. And understand, and I'm sure that you understand, that to have someone say, please read my daughter's screenplay, it's like a nightmare. I mean, everybody, it's just a recipe for everybody sort of becoming an idiot. But eventually I was getting so frustrated that I said, Dad, you will never see your grandson again if you don't get this script to Jonathan Demme. And the extortion part actually worked. And so I'm a big advocate of extortion. and that's how it happened, really.
It sounds like you're practicing some of the family jujitsu in your own movie.
You got to do what you got to do. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think the system is really difficult. I'm very connected. And it took me forever to get a movie produced. I've been writing for 13 years and trying to get better for 13 years. And I have every advantage on the planet. It's hard.
All right. You are the granddaughter of Lena Horne and the daughter of Sidney Lumet. So coming from a family like that, a family of film, song, letters, history, what did it do for you? And also, as you were working for 13 years on the script, did you ever think, I'm a failure within this family? I just can't finish this.
Well, the 13 years was, there were four or five scripts, different ones, within that 13-year period. So it wasn't just one for 13 years. Although my mom did write a book that took her 14 years. I don't know how she would have done it. You can't really fail. And this sounds rather odd, but the odds are so astronomically just stacked against one, I think, in movie business and entertainment business, that just to keep going is, I think, a success story. Maybe it was total hubris on my part. I never felt like a failure in comparison because I hadn't had any, we'll say, validated success, sort of media validated success. I'm a school teacher and I have kids and I have this lovely life, which I regard as highly successful. I am really proud of the people in my family because they work really hard. Being honest matters and being brave matters, and that's cool. Maybe I felt an extra level of scrutiny, but on the flip side of the extra level of scrutiny is the extra level of access that someone like me has. I can eventually get my script to Jonathan Demme. Most people have a much harder time doing it. So it's a trade-off.
Well, Jenny, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Oh, great to talk to you, too.
Jenny Lumet is the screenwriter of the film Rachel Getting Married, and she spoke to us from NPR Studios in New York City. Wayne Brady is a versatile entertainer who's celebrating his 10th year on television. With three Emmys under his belt, the 36-year-old is now turning some of his attention to the music business. This is a cut from his new CD, A Long Time Coming.
All of our friends keep saying we should be more social, 'cause we keep to ourselves most of the time. They just don't understand what we got going on.
Brady got his start on the ABC television show Whose Line Is It Anyway? The show used the art of improvisation to deliver squeaky clean family entertainment. That reputation tended to separate Brady from other performers of the hip-hop generation, and it led his critics to speculate on his connection to black culture. Brady and I talked about that, his new CD, and the improvisational skills that gave him his start.
Improv is a dual-edged sword for me because of how I think people that watch Whose Line still think of it as that they really love it and they respect it, but they think of it as this party trick that you couldn't possibly have made up those things. I say, yeah, we did. It's not scripted. No, you didn't. Come on, tell me the truth. The double-edged sword is then everyone expects you to be able to do that all the time, and then also that's all that you do. So I may go in for a meeting with a director, and he goes, "Are you cool doing a script? Of course I'm cool doing it. That's what I am. I'm an actor first and foremost. So I do love it, but at certain times I've come to dread being asked to do it because I know that some folks think of it as this trick that I can just pull out of my butt at any time."
All right, let's talk about your music. Your album, Long Time Coming, has been getting some really good reviews, and it's got a real mix. But what I wanted to start with is Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come.
I was born by the river in a little town, just like that river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come.
So why'd you choose this song? And I'm a huge Sam Cooke fan. I am not a historian, but I'm, you know, his voice sends me over the moon, and you take charge of the song.
When you do a cover, you need to have a couple covers on your album, because it gives people something to grab onto that is familiar. But you also want to make that cover your own. I wanted to do Change Is Gonna Come. It's a timeless song anyway, but it's got this urgency to it now that there's, not to sound cliche, but you really can smell this change in the air, that you know that folks have put up with something for only so long, that it's been quite a road to hoe. And in walks Obama. And not just because he's black and I'm black, do I like him? You look at him and I feel that he's the real deal. I think maybe when people look at him, maybe we're feeling the same thing that people in the 60s felt when Kennedy was president. And I hope that's what the song says.
What about the racial politics? You have spoofed your own identity on the Dave Chappelle show.
Not my identity. No.
Okay, what was that? Identity. What was that sketch about for you?
And the reason that I have to say that is, and this is something that it irritates me still, because you and I just met. You don't know me.
You got that right.
All you know of me is, you can look it up on Wikipedia, or don't even say that, because I could change an entry if I wanted to. I mean, you could look anything up online, but you've got a video history that you could go back and look at episodes of Whose Line and then when I started, and Vinyl Justice, to any of the Disney shows I did, to this parade, to Miss America, to this soap opera, to this thing, and then you form your own opinion. And then your opinion may be, oh, well, Wayne is white. And I'm not saying that's what it is, because I think that you're far too smart and well-spoken to be as ignorant as some people that have thought that. That's not my identity. That's Wayne Brady getting a job and fulfilling that job. I was on Whose Line, and then I was on Vinyl Justice, or vice versa, and then I got my sketch show, and then my talk show, and they're all Disney-owned, by the way. So within any of those parameters, when, at any time, could I have been anything even edgy? Is such a stupid Hollywood buzzword, but there were certain very clean, family-friendly choices that had to be made.
But I'm curious why you did the sketch.
I did the sketch because, being a very self-aware person, I would be completely dumb and deaf to not know that there was a segment that would say stuff like that about me. That to turn on and hear Paul Mooney, who has appointed himself the grand poobah of all that is black, say his joke about me making Brian Gumbel look like Malcolm X, to seeing myself spoofed on Mad TV by Ari Spears, and then sitting back and going, why? What did I do that is so out of the black norm? And so I thought about that, and when I was leaving the talk show and the Chappelle show came along, I said, okay, you know what? I'm going to go after that particular caricature that I see in my head, because the Chappelle show sketch wasn't a surprise to me, because I know that's what I do and that's what I find funny.
I can't take this money, man. This money ain't clean, man.
Dave, relax.
No, man, I can't relax. I don't want this money.
Dave, you are too uptight.
No, no.
Here,
smoke this.
No, I'm cool.
Let us smoke this.
Take it. Come on, smoke it.
Man, I don't want to smoke.
This is not an option. If you do not smoke this, we have a problem. Ain't no damn after school special. Smoke it.
I could never do something like that in daytime, No, because in daytime, here's my next guest from Wisconsin cooking her famous marmalade cookies. Mmm, and now here's some soap guest that I really don't know. That's the reality of daytime TV. Eventually, I knew that that's not who I wanted to be and where I wanted to be, because it was cutting my legs out from underneath me. So I did that to take power back. Instead of letting Aries, very, very unfunny, and letting Paul Mooney, didn't know what he's talking about, and other places take pot shots at me, I said, I'm going to blow holes in that same thing that you are doing, and I'm going to be funnier. And that I'm going to be so much funnier than you ever were. So that's why I did it, and I was so fortunate that it came up.
It's a classic sketch.
It's a classic sketch. It's in the it's in the Museum of TV History as one of the top sketches of all time. It's like number three or five or something. That's an honor. And so it achieved a couple things. I think it helped get me from under this thing that I was being saddled with, and it showed the people who thought they were funny doing that, like, no, this is what I do. And I don't say that in a prideful way whatsoever, but I do say it as someone who's very confident in what I do, because this is all I've got. I love this.
So I asked you already, you know, what do you like better out of all the things that you do? You say they're all me, but what's ahead? Are you going to do you think, more music, more stage, more TV, or just keep going for all of it?
I will keep going for all of it. We have a limited amount of time on this planet, and my thing is to get as much done as I can. I'm definitely going to do another record when that time comes up. I've already started writing because I'm really, really excited, but we have to continue pushing this one, and it's doing really well. But what I plan on doing is I'll be in New York the tail end of next year, hopefully doing a one-man show, which would be the first, I want to say the first, the first improvisational musical with characters and impersonations that is just me. And we'll see how that turns out. And I'm just happy to be doing this, you know. It's a big deal to be on TV 10 years. So I'm going to keep doing it.
Wayne Brady, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Nothing ordinary
about the way I feel. Comedian and actor Wayne Brady's new album is Long Time Coming. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, comedian David Alan Greer joins us to talk about his new Comedy Central show, Chocolate News. Special plans. Don't need no- I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.